Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Sprawl, Reconsidering the Weird American Suburbs by Jason Diamond. Narrated by Peter Lerman. Though you have done nothing shameful, they will want you to be ashamed. Wendell Berry. Preface. I'm suburban. I'm of the suburbs. I've spent my entire adulthood in cities, but I still get nostalgic when I smell freshly cut grass. It brings me back to the malls of my youth, to the food court at Town Center Boca Raton, the mall we used to go to whenever I visited my grandparents in South Florida, or the old tobacco store in some forgotten shopping center in the middle of the country. I love grilling meat on a Weber grill I spent an hour trying to light. And by God, I miss not having a never-ending stream of cars honking outside my window. It took me a long time to admit any of that. I was, at best, ambivalent about where I come from, but filled with pure hate is more like it. Whenever somebody asked, I always told them I was from Chicago. That's the way most people do it, right? If you're from Round Rock, Texas, you'll say you're from Austin. If you grew up in Fountain, in a house with four bedrooms, a two-car garage, and a big backyard, you just tell people Colorado, because they won't know your hometown. If you're from Long Island, ran on the cross-country team, and lived in a quiet little subdivision, but moved away to college and never looked back, you'll tell anyone who asks you're from New York, which isn't wrong. You just hope they assume you mean Manhattan and not Hicksville, which is over an hour away. Yet, getting to a place where I could clearly and honestly tell people, yes, I grew up in suburbia, in neighborhoods up and down Lake Michigan, took a long time. I left as a teenager and immediately started telling people I was from Chicago. I never looked back, until I did. After an adulthood spent mostly in two of America's biggest cities, Chicago and New York City, the suburbs came back into my life in my mid-30s. It started slowly. Weekend trips to my in-law's house outside Hartford, Connecticut, in a quaint little town called Avon in the shadow of Talcott Mountain. From their backyard, you can look up and see Hubline Tower, the castle A1 steak sauce and Smirnoff vodka manufacturer Gilbert Hubline built his wife in the early 20th century. You can walk barefoot around my father-in-law's immaculately green grass and gaze at the hawks as they circle or watch the woodchucks scatter about. It's country quaint, but it's suburbia, no doubt. Drive 5 minutes and there's a Chili's, an antique dealer coffee shop, a hotel bar I sometimes sneak away to for a quiet drink, a few car dealerships, some elite private schools, a couple of local farms that sell pumpkins and cider, and a golf course. Then, another golf course, and another. It's Gilmore Girls Cozy, with a deliberate small-town feel baked into the city plans, even though the population reaches over 18,000, and the bulk of the housing is from the 20th and 21st century. It's all thanks to that post-war boom. The place jumped from 1,738 residents in 1930 to 11,201 50 years later in 1980. I hear a lot of debate over what is and isn't a suburb. One element that can place somewhere in the is category is when the population increases after World War II, but industry isn't added to lure people. People move to the little town to work in other nearby cities, namely Hartford, a 15-minute drive away. It became a suburb out of necessity. There isn't all that much to do in this small suburban town, and frankly, that's nice to me. It's still and quiet. I don't have to worry about getting on the subway and dealing with people coughing on me, or some guy clipping his fingernails between taking bites of a burrito. Yes, I've actually seen this. There aren't sirens and jackhammers and people yelling outside my window. When I go to my in-laws, butterflies flutter around in the summertime, and there's a fireplace to sit by in the winter. In the city, there's the dirt and God knows whatever else covered snow, and rats, lots of rats. That all said, I think I'll spend the rest of my life in cities. The suburbs are nice to visit, but at this point, more of my life has been lived as an urbanite than not. Everything else feels like a vacation. I'm part of that group of younger Generation Xers and older millennials who've moved back to cities after our parents and grandparents left to build a better life with backyards and places to park their station wagons. And I'm pretty sure I'm staying put. But who knows? The American suburbs were the great promise to the baby boomers. If you were white and middle class, a little piece of the post-war pie was yours for the taking in the years after World War II. Suburbia was the idea of the good life, something humans had been looking to attain for centuries, but only the wealthy could afford. A place outside the city. After the war ended, that dream became more attainable, especially, and this needs to be repeated, if you were white. The Federal Housing Administration, starting in 1934 and all the way until 1968, graded neighborhoods from A to D. Areas with large black populations usually received the lowest grade, and those same black people who wanted to make a change were shut out of attaining loans to help them afford housing in newer, nicer, safer areas. This is enough to make any sane person want to rebel against the idea of the suburbs, a place that actively kept groups of people out. But as I'll show, there's more that has colored our view of what the suburbs are and aren't. We have so many ideas of what we think suburbia is, yet we don't realize how suburban we've become, whether we live in them or not. The suburban way is taking over our lives. Walk down Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn's Williamsburg neighborhood, and you no longer find mom-and-pop stores or Spanish and Yiddish speakers outnumbering English speakers. You find an Apple store, a Whole Foods, and banks where independent businesses used to be. Cities might be our media hubs, but suburbia makes the news. It's where horrible violence happens, like the shootings of unarmed black teenagers Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown. Martin in a gated Florida community by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch member once described as being obsessed with suburban law and order minutia, and Brown by a police officer in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson. School massacres from Littleton, Colorado to Newtown, Connecticut and Parkland, Florida seem to almost always happen in places where people tell the news some variation of, "This isn't supposed to happen here." The suburbs, we're also told, are the battleground where each and every election will be decided. Today, over half of all Americans, 55% according to one Pew study, live in the suburbs. If we want to live together in this country, we must gain a better understanding of the suburbs as a concept, a place that's made up of white people, African Americans, Mexicans, Chinese, Russian, and Indian people, and just about every other nationality or group you can think of. LGBTQ people live in suburbia. There are churches, mosques, synagogues, and all other places of worship in the suburbs. The suburbs aren't democratic or republican. There's poverty, violence, and drug abuse in the suburbs. But there's also creativity, passion, and genuinely interesting people living in these places we'd normally never classify as such. The suburbs aren't one thing or another. We try to pigeonhole suburbia, act like it's a great big boring monolith of conformity and tract housing. But there's so much more to it than that, and we need to understand it better. Otherwise, I believe the things we consider to be true about the suburbs, the fears and misconceptions we have about these places, will overtake us. The title of this book was borrowed in part from speculative fiction writer William Gibson. In his work, notably The Sprawl Trilogy, Neuromancer, 1984, Count Zero, 1986, and Mona Lisa Overdrive, 1988, Gibson gives us the near-future Boston-Atlanta Metropolitan Axis, BAMA, megacity. I sometimes see traces of that fictional dystopia as I drive down endless roads lined with strip malls and car dealerships. I've seen this sprawl not only in America, but all over the world, from Canada to China. The sprawl, to me, is soulless. It's bad planning. It's corporate. It's bland. And it's spreading. It's everything becoming one, and not in some utopian hippie love-in way. The sprawl is building more stuff on top of stuff. It's designing without thinking. It's building without caring. It's putting up another golf course or a third home goods store, or adding another chain restaurant instead of propping up local independent business. It's this car culture Americans are still so obsessed with. We get into these things, drive up our wide streets to get on the highway, and our feelings and compassion seem to go out the window the longer we sit in traffic. The sprawl, not the suburbs, is what I don't like. I want to separate the two to better understand and appreciate these places that are everywhere. Since I'm from the suburbs, and the suburbs have given us some of our greatest creators of science fiction, from Ray Bradbury to Gibson to George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, I'll use another analogy. The suburbs are Anakin Skywalker. Yes, I'm making a Star Wars comparison. But it's apt not only because the franchise's creator, George Lucas, grew up in what is often referred to as the sleepy California suburb of Modesto, but also because Anakin is a flawed, imperfect, but ultimately good person. He's seduced by the dark side and eventually turned into a masked cyborg version of himself. My aim is to show how the suburbs are Anakin and the sprawl is Darth Vader. We want to find our good side, however flawed and deeply buried it might be, and fight off the evil guy in the cool black uniform. I can say with certainty that suburbia is an outsider. I'm putting all the designations of the suburbs, the exurbs, edge cities, and commuter towns, under this umbrella to avoid confusion. Schaumburg, Illinois, for instance, is a large, sprawling area with nearly 75,000 residents. 74,184 at the time of this writing, malls and lots of tall glass buildings that's home to the North American branch of Zurich, a Swiss insurance company. The Motorola Solutions headquarters was also there for years. That sounds like a city, yet it's a suburb. On the other side, there are parts of Queens, New York that look like Grosse Pointe, Michigan, or Simsbury, Connecticut, but it's still the city. Queens, just like its fellow borough of Brooklyn, which could qualify as one of the first true American suburbs, is within, not outside, the city. What makes something a suburb is where it is in relation to a city. The Merriam-Webster definition of suburb is an outlying part of a city or town. An outlier, something other than a city. It's suburban. It's beneath a city. Outsiders are odd. You look down on things that are below you. The suburbs, too, have taken on the status of cultural oddity, something Rod Serling picked up on in some of the most iconic episodes of The Twilight Zone, and Shirley Jackson and John Cheever channeled in their very different types of fiction. Matt Groening drew it as the Springfield of The Simpsons. David Lynch and Stephen King placed monsters, human and otherwise, in the suburbs. And even today, acclaimed indie rock bands like Arcade Fire write albums like 2010's The Suburbs, and filmmakers from Jordan Peele to Greta Gerwig mine suburbia for inspiration. I look around my Brooklyn apartment and I see so much influenced by cities. Books by New Yorkers Edith Wharton and James Baldwin, records produced in Los Angeles, and old Motown LPs from Detroit. Hats representing sports teams from Chicago and Boston. We know what was built in the cities. Industry, commerce, media, political power. What we ignore is just how much the suburbs have influenced our culture. America's early days were rural. Then the urban century sprang up during the Industrial Revolution. Today, we're still very much in the middle of the suburban century. America has fashioned itself from the suburbs since the end of World War II. So many people are suburbanites, and we're constantly reminded of how much influence the suburbs yield over the rest of the world. Learning to better understand anything of such importance is vital. Suburbia's influence will only grow, not only in America, but throughout the world. On nearly every continent, there are places that could be considered suburbs that have populations of over 1 million. And in the U.S., while there's been a lot of talk about the boom some of our once-forgotten cities have experienced over the last decade, the fact is the suburbs are still growing. According to the Brookings Institute, the 53 major metropolitan areas across the country outpaced suburbia in growth in 2010 to 2011 and 2014 to 2015. But in 2015 to 2016, city growth declined to 0.82%. While the suburban growth rate also dipped from the previous year, it was still above its urban counterpart with a rate of 0.89% growth. Cities are great. I live in one, and I wrote the bulk of this book from my apartment in Brooklyn and the library on 42nd that's in the heart of Manhattan. Yet the suburbs are legion, and people argue they're more livable than the cities. They offer so many of the things I hear my other friends in cities complaining they miss, from more space to less noise, all the time. Yet we keep staying in the city for whatever reason, because our jobs are here. We can walk to the subway or the little restaurant that serves the best fried chicken, or the bar that makes the best Bloody Mary. Stuff is happening in cities. As one person told Al Jazeera in 2017, it's the culture, the food, the shopping that keeps them living in a city and not a suburb. Another said, there's just something kind of cool about a big city with skyscrapers and glass windows and, kind of the hustle and bustle of downtown living. Adding, it's pretty cool. I've never heard anybody say that about the suburbs. While every suburb is different in some way, what links them from coast to coast is that undercurrent of strangeness, of bottled-up energy, rage, passion, and creativity, the great suburban exports. As a structured and structuring way of being, suburban sprawl foments a kind of imaginativeness in people that's both unique to the boring suburban imagination and reflective of an alienating longing for the archetypal urban lifestyle. These emotions engendered by living in the suburbs are consistent over time: anxiety, boredom, and alienation. Understanding how and why the suburbs are this way can help us better understand the present and the future, whether you live in them or not. Because America, by moving farther out of the cities and building new subdivisions filled with single-family households, bordered by malls and office parks, created modern suburban sprawl. But in the end, that sprawl reshaped America, became our modern condition, a state of mind. More stuff, more cars, more houses, more stores, and less of what we need. The suburbs were a smart, practical idea that was put into practice in all the wrong ways, and they deserve to be scrutinized. This book isn't a celebration of the suburbs as an idea or a way of life. Rather, it examines how the suburbs came to be what they are today, how much they've influenced our world, and what we can learn going forward, since the suburbs aren't going anywhere anytime soon. Chapter 1. We Were Promised Hoverboards. The future isn't what it used to be. At least our interest in what the future might look like has changed, as has our enthusiasm. Every generation has to listen to the previous ones talk about the way it used to be. But people don't want to speculate about what will be as much as they used to. Imagining how the future will look in 10, 20, 50 years was, especially after World War II, an American obsession. There was the Leave It to Beaver and station wagon life, portrayed in photographs by Maynard L. Parker on the covers of House Beautiful and Better Homes magazines. There was also the Jetsons, with their flying cars and robot maid. People dreamed of not only having man walk on the moon, but also someday living on other planets. And that vision often looked suburban. In 1957, when Walt Disney Imagineering and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, with thanks to their sponsor, Monsanto, showed us the House of the Future, where microwaves ensured everything is done just right at amazing speed, and furniture made of practical but comfortable, serviceable yet beautiful plastic. It was suburban. There was a lot of enthusiasm about how things would look someday, and the future could often be found in the suburbs. The stereotypical mid-century picture of the white, middle-class family and their perfect normal lives was the past, present, and future model of the country that companies and advertisers wanted to portray. After the chaos and bleakness of the 60s and 70s, there was an understandable desire for a time when Americans were intrigued by what could be. A cursory look at the politics and pop culture landscape of the decade shows that in the 80s, people yearned for a past that was enamored with the future. From the former movie star running the country to one of the highest-grossing films of the decade, Back to the Future, taking viewers back to the Eisenhower administration. And while the Greed is Good decade had more than its fair share of films set during the formative years of the baby boomers, Back to the Future offers a cool teenager going back 30 years, from 1985 to 1955, getting his parents together, saving the life of his friend, Dr. Emmett Brown, altering the future, and possibly inventing skateboarding. Michael J. Fox's Marty McFly is one of the great film characters of the 80s, and the movie is the type of classic that's almost certainly playing somewhere in the world every minute of every day. But Back to the Future also provides a perfect encapsulation of the rise and fall of the American suburbs throughout the first half of the trilogy's opening film, something that gets lost in discussion of the best lines, the DeLorean time machine, and debating what the movies got right and wrong about the 2000s. It's dusk when Marty rolls home on his skateboard. The camera pulls back to show us the entrance to Lion Estates, a subdivision in the fictional California town of Hill Valley. A lone street lamp illuminates the wide stretch of pavement. The houses are pushed back from the curb. There are massive power lines in the distance, and there are a couple of trees on the block. Hardly anything natural about it. It's unremarkable in every way. The shot is painted in a bluish gray because of the time of day, but it's fair to assume it always looks like that. It's lonely. Something you realize after you've watched enough movies and TV shows about the suburbs is that they're often shot that way. At the front of the development's entrance, a pair of lion statues keep watch. It's hard to tell, but they're pretty weathered from the California sun, and nobody cares enough to fix them up. Lion Estates has seen better days. There's an Edward Hopper quality to the whole shot. A lot more to unpack if you're willing. But, of course, there's not much reason to do that if you're just watching the film to see Marty cruising the space-time continuum and looking cool, which is totally reasonable since that is what the movie's about. Marty is bored. His family is at the lower end of the middle, and his life in Hill Valley is unfulfilling. His brother works at Burger King. His sister doesn't seem to do anything. His dad is a nebbish with some low-level number-crunching job. And his mom is a burnt-out housewife who likes to start cocktail hour a few hours earlier than she should. It's a middling existence, one Marty desperately wants to escape. The little one-floor ranch home with transmission towers in the backyard that are probably frying his brain. It isn't so much that there's much wrong with the house itself, which is a real home on a street in the San Fernando Valley, lined with pickup trucks, owned by the mostly working-class neighbors. Rather, it's what the house and neighborhood have become in the film, and what they've come to represent: deterioration. The American dream stripped of all its sheen. This is the future that Marty will try to get back to. When Marty goes back 30 years to 1955, we see a different version of his hometown. His Lyon Estate subdivision is still an empty chunk of land that will soon be filled with houses and concrete, with a bucolic background filled in by trees and hills. There is a sign with an illustration of a perky white nuclear family and the slogan, "Live in the home of tomorrow, today." That and the lion statues at the main entrance, which look like they're standing watch. The 1955 version is vibrant and more alive than the stale and forgotten 1985 version. When he walks the 2 miles into town, the little Eisenhower-era Hill Valley downtown is Main Street, USA, the type of place where young men in spotless uniforms run out to service any car that visits the gas station. And people are out walking around, enjoying their town. 1985 Hill Valley is mostly desolate and falling apart, with trash blowing everywhere, and the movie theater showing porn on a big screen that, in 1955, is playing Cattle Queen of Montana, starring Barbara Stanwyck and Ronald Reagan, for 50 cents. Yes, this is largely baby boomer nostalgia for a time when the owner of Lou's Cafe could crack a colored mayor, that'll be the day, when the African-American busboy says he'd like to be mayor of the town someday. The character, Goldie Wilson, is, in fact, the mayor of Hill Valley in Marty's 1985. But the juxtaposition of the two Hill Valleys paints an adequate picture of suburbia's boom and bust in the decades after the Second World War. Coming just a few years after the end of the Vietnam War, gas shortages, the Iran hostage crisis, and in the final years of the Cold War, the 1985 version of Hill Valley also represents the disillusionment Americans everywhere felt. From farmers in rural areas dealing with one financial heartache after another, as exports fell and interest rates and farm equipment prices rose, to urbanites struggling with crumbling buildings and skyrocketing crime rates. The breakdown of the suburbs encapsulates all that. Baked into the selling of suburbs in the middle of the 20th century was that it was a change, an escape from the problems of small towns and big urban centers. At a time when the suburbs, the American dream, were showing signs of decline, Back to the Future summed up the suburban zeitgeist better than most people might have realized. 3 years after Back to the Future came out, in 1988, Studs Terkel introduced us to Ray and Sandy Scholl in his book The Great Divide. The Scholls lived in a Chicagoland suburb they described as a gray-collar area, where the people who make up the community range from welfare Section 8 to some rather affluent people. Terkel notes that where they live is your classic bedroom community, and that it is more an enclave of sub-communities, one being wholly alien to another. Though they are all within the radius of a couple of square miles, they are planets apart. He goes on to mention the shopping malls, the chains like Kmart and McDonald's, and how all the streets have names connected to the Native Americans, who once lived and thrived in the same place. You've maybe never been to the area he's talking about, but if you've been to any suburb, you can easily imagine it. Ray is a Vietnam War vet who works as an independent insurance broker. "I'm not at a point where I can be your typical insurance agent and spend 3 days at a golf course," he says with a laugh. Sandy owns a small commercial cleaning service. There's one exchange early in the interview, right after Ray describes the kind of people who live in the suburbs, where Sandy notes that the middle class is disappearing from the area. She says, No matter how well you do, you're never quite able to stay ahead. It's harder and harder for the average person to attain the average American dream.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?